Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, a Thursday afternoon edition. Dennis Rodkin writes about real estate for Crane Chicago Business, and he is in the studio now. Dennis, welcome back.
Hi, Steve.
Hey, good news. We're finally making money on our houses.
Finally, yes. First year.
So last year, the first year since 2008, that Chicagoans on average made money on the house that they sold?
Yeah. Now, of course, this is average. This is averaged over the whole market. Certainly, people selling in hot places like Lincoln Park have been making money. But when you look at the entire metropolitan area, which this data firm, Adam Data Solutions, did, you find that in the Chicago area, on average, people lost for the previous 7 years when selling, but last year profited. And one thing to keep in mind is nationally, it turned up two full years ago.
Right.
2014 was when people started profiting, while in Chicago, it was 2016.
I was going to say, and they didn't profit much, right? 5% here compared to over 20% nationally?
3% here and $5,000 per, yeah. And one thing to keep in mind, so what Adam does is this is how much you paid for the house whenever you bought the house and how much you sold it for in 2016. What is the difference and how does that average out? One thing it does not include is if you'd made any improvements to the house along
right,
the way.
Right.
That isn't figured in. So what we're saying is, you know, average profits of $5,000, but what if you spent $6,000 on a bathroom, that sort of thing. That's not figured in.
And that's the sort of thing Michael Jordan does at his homes, right? When is he going to get his money out of his house?
Well, you know, the problem here is we don't know how much he put in. We know he wants nearly $15 million. He wants $14.8
million. He wanted almost 30, didn't he?
He used to want $29 million. Yeah, okay. 5 years ago this month when he put it on the market. I don't know what he spent. We know that in the early 90s, he spent about $1 million on the land. Do not know what it costs to build, expand, renovate. But 5 years ago this month, he put it on the market at $29 million. Just a couple of years ago, it came down several times. And a couple of years ago, it landed at 14. I think you know this. It landed at $14.885 million. And
right.
The reason for that price is?
I don't know that.
The digits, 14885, add up to 23, his number.
Nice. Well, you know, I like to tell people I live about 2 miles and $28 million from his house.
So do I.
Wait, $28.9 million from his house.
Exactly.
So I go by on Sundays just to see who's going through the open house, and there just hasn't been much traffic.
There hasn't. You know, the thing is, what I was trying to find out when doing this story that's out today is there going to be any change? The price was coming down for a couple of years. There was lots of media attention. They got a walkthrough on the Today Show.
Right.
They had all sorts of things happening. There was an offer a couple of years ago that if you buy the house, you get one pair of every version of Air Jordans in whatever size you request. All sorts of media stuff. And again, the price kept coming down. But in about 2 years, nothing has happened. Nothing. And nobody will talk to me. And in fact, I think you saw, it's not even on. So it's got two real estate agents.
I was going to say there's like this big money sort of agent
right.
out of L.A.
Out of L.A. So it's represented by an agent here in Chicago and also represented by this celebrity agency that sells multimillion dollar homes all over the country. They've been involved for about 2 years. The Chicago agent has been involved for five. And as of yesterday, Michael Jordan's house isn't even on the website of that LA agency. So I don't know. You know, we may find a
cold case file.
Exactly. We may find, you know, they actually had a deal in the works or something like that. All they would tell me is, oh, it's a computer error. But here is here's a house that, you know, it was on the Today Show. They had videos where they did it as if it was the house was narrating itself. I'm the greatest, as if
right.
Michael Jordan's house would talk like Michael Jordan. And now you can't even find it on their website.
And if I could just a personal testimonial, it's walking distance to a great hardware store. I mean, Mutual is just around the corner.
I'm sure that's why Jordan built there.
That's where I get all my furnace filters. So I can vouch for that. What's the story? I didn't really know there even was a Cook County Land Bank. What's that? And and is this a chance to get a real deal?
It is a chance to get a real deal. The land bank is something that was founded about 3 years ago in the wake of the foreclosure crisis. The idea was that this quasi-county agency would buy up the properties that were pick up, I should say, the properties that are in foreclosure, clean all the red tape off them. Because often when you get a foreclosure, it has liens. And
so you don't want to mess with it.
Right. So they would just wipe it out and you could get the home. And I've written about some of the houses being redeployed to builders and things like that. So what the land bank announced this week, that we had a story about it on Monday, is they're now also the holders of several thousand vacant lots in the south side, in the south and west sides and in the south suburbs, and they're offering to sell those off. Again, cleansed of red tape. That's the important part.
Are these all vacant lots, or some of the vacant properties are all lots?
This is the new part, is the vacant lots.
Okay.
It's empty land, over 4,400 empty lots, and there are more to come. And so you, as a developer or as a neighbor, somebody in the neighborhood wants to build a community garden, $3,000 to $5,000, get a Chicago-sized lot. And the important part is you don't have to deal with the red tape. Go through the court process and all those things it takes to acquire it.
You mentioned a garden, but a lot of times you buy a piece of property like this, you're obligated to build or develop it. Is that the case in this?
They have no limitations, is what they said. So part of the reason to sell these lots off is to attract developers. These are neighborhoods that really need development, that aren't getting what the North Centers and Lincoln Parks and stuff are getting in terms of development. So if you sell these lots more cheaply and without the red tape, the reasoning is they'll pull in more developers, but also homeowners, anybody else. And the idea is they're not putting any limitations on. You don't have to conform to affordability requirements. You don't have to build within a certain amount of time. So perhaps a developer, let's just say, buys a bunch of lots and sits on them for 20 years.
Right.
But at least they've got clear ownership, you know, and they're
sort of like what Blackstone did with apartments. Was it Blackstone with apartments?
With apartments and foreclosed homes.
Right.
Yeah. Well, Blackstone is a slightly different model. They bought up a lot of foreclosed homes in order to fix them up and maintain them as rentals. And
until the market got hot.
Until the market gets hot. And as far as I can tell, not too many have been sold off yet, but they bought quite a few over the years. So this land bank thing is another piece of that sort of all-out approach to solving the mess that was made by the foreclosure crisis.
Dennis Rodkin, nice to talk to you again. Come by in a couple weeks.
Thanks, Steve. Yeah.
1221, this is the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Elise Glink will be here a little bit later to talk about niche marketing rather than casting a wide net, maybe focusing in on your target, figuring out who that is, and then figuring out a way to reel them in. And also, Congressman Mike Quigley, just after the headlines coming up at the bottom of the hour. Right now, Bill Geiger is in the studio. Our regular conversations with Bill are sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management. Mr. Geiger, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Good afternoon, sir. Good to be here.
How are you? Everything good? Winter's fine?
Everything's fine. Thank you.
Hey, so we talk about retirement savings and planning and all of that. And one of the things that you and I talk about a lot is, and this goes back to a conversation I had with someone 20 years ago when he was maybe 60 or 70. And I said, it's time to pull back because it's time for you to, you don't want to put yourself at risk. And he said, look, must have been 50 or 60. He said, I'm going to live another 30 years. You know, I can't really give up now. And that's sort of a dilemma I think a lot of us face. We're living longer, which is great.
Yeah.
But we've got a plan to live longer.
Well, living longer is a blessing and a curse, Steve. If you're in your late 50s to early 60s, as a couple, one of you is probably going to live into your 90s. If you have longevity on either side of your family, probably well into your 90s.
Yeah.
And with advances in medical science, maybe even longer. The blessing part is, of course, you get to enjoy life longer. You get to see grandkids grow up. You get to travel. You get to do all those great things. But the curse part is, can you afford to live that long?
Right.
Do you have the money? Will your portfolio keep up with inflation for 30 to 35 years? Will you have the income and the growth necessary to not run out of money? You know, there was a young man in my office yesterday, and I was talking to him about what we're going to talk about on the show today. And he said, my grandmother is still alive. She's 95 years old. He says she ran out of money 10 years ago.
Right. So where is she now? What's she do?
Well, here's what's going on. The kids are trading grandma back and forth every week. Grandma's in a different kid's house each week.
Right.
And they're complaining about it.
Well, my kids might take my wife in, but I don't think they will take me in when I'm 90.
No. You know, I remember a client in their 70s, a woman that had been divorced for quite a long time, told me, she says, Bill, she says, the only way that you get respect in retirement is if you have money.
Mm.
And it's tough, but that's the way it is.
All right, so that brings us, so I suppose you could argue then, if you're living longer, you're also living longer to save more, right? I mean, are we retiring later, or that's not what we're looking at?
You know, it's not necessarily. It depends upon how your portfolio is structured.
I mean, I don't want to work after I'm 65. Well, I don't want to work after I'm 55.
And the key is...
I don't want to work after one.
you want to quit next week?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
The key is how your portfolio is structured, and the sooner you start transitioning to a retirement-type portfolio, the better off you're going to be. I mean, right. Think about it. Your portfolio shouldn't look like a 30-year-old's.
No.
30-year-old blows himself up. He's got 30 years to make it back up again. If you're in your late 50s, early 60s, you don't have 30 years. So one key is protect what you have. Absolutely hang on to it. The second key is conservative growth. And the third is to start creating income as early as possible. So when you retire, you've got something to supplement your Social Security with.
Okay, so what's more, let's say you're in your late 50s or early 60s and you're not quite there, mm-hmm. right? You don't have what you need to have to sustain the income. Do you then stay out of that income generating sort of portfolio to get there?
No,
or what do you do?
No, because there's income strategies.
But then you're going to be short, right?
Not necessarily. There are income strategies that the sooner you start, the more powerful they are. Now, I'm not talking about your whole portfolio. I'm talking about part of your portfolio. And if you have part of your portfolio creating enough income to go with Social Security to keep you alive, then the rest of your portfolio can be for growth, and you can last for a long, 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 long time.
All right. So when people come in to talk to you,
yes.
what percentage of them do you think are ready or are informed and prepared?
I can probably count them really, honest to God, on one hand.
Really?
Yeah.
Are they not listening to us, Bill?
Well, it's maybe. Most people are. I look at their portfolio, and honest to God, Steve, it still looks like a 30-year-old's.
Right.
Is
that because? And I think I can see this where you're all over it at one point in your life. I'm going to do it. Yeah. And then you do exactly what you should do for that time of your life.
Right.
And then you think I'm good.
Well, not only that, but we've been coming out of 2008 now for what, 8-9 years,
right?
And the market's been good. And you could have a really risky portfolio and not know it, right?
Right.
You only really realize sometimes you have a really risky portfolio is
when it hits
and it goes down.
Right.
Steve, the folks out there, if you're not sure whether your portfolio is set up correctly to last you for the rest of your life, I'm going to sit down personally on a complimentary basis to help you put together a full-blown retirement plan, a full-blown financial plan for your retirement.
Great. Bill, good to see you again.
Good to see you,
sir.
Come
back in a couple weeks, will you?
Will do.
Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch, 12:35 here in the city of Chicago, WGN Radio. Thanks very much for tuning in. On a phone line, I'm presuming from Washington, D.C., is Congressman Mike Kelly, Congressman Democrat from the North Side. I'm sorry, I said Mike Kelly, Congressman. Mike Quigley, how are you?
I'm fine. I'm literally a few steps off of the House floor because we're just finishing a vote series.
You and I know how funny it is I called you Kelly because I think I've probably known you longer than any politician I've known in Chicago.
And I've probably known you as long as any person in your line of work from the early 80s and the no lights in Wrigley Field days.
Yeah, we go back to the fight over lights at Wrigley Field way back when you were working for Bernie Hansen. Who would have thought back then that you'd be not just a member of Congress? I know that I don't want to press you because I know you're not briefed on what you can say and all that just yet, but you're also on the Intelligence Committee. And if you could just speak briefly, I want to talk to you about Sanctuary City and all that, but if you could just speak briefly, we're reading more and more about this raid over the weekend in Yemen and that there were some mistakes made. There are just some questions about it, and I just wonder what your view is, what you can share with us right now.
Well, I can speak more generally, and that is when something like this happens, inevitably there's a shaking out period, a time in which we learn so much more about what happened. So I've learned in 8 years here that a rush to judgment is often a mistake. I think the general lesson the public should take from this is the president's thoughts about the intel community. And he's comparing it to Nazi Germany, and he said he didn't need them, and then he's with them, then he's against them, and he's with them. And the fact is, without good intelligence, people die. Our soldiers, innocent civilians, and since 9/11, there have been approximately 80 terror plots on the United States. Almost all of those have been foiled. And they've been foiled not because we had 100,000 troops on the ground someplace. They were foiled because of good intelligence work. So the short answer is it's too early to really detail what happened and assess this. But I hope it burns in the minds of those making these decisions in Washington and the Trump administration that the intelligence community is extraordinarily important, and you're surrounded by really smart people in many of these government agencies. You should rely on them. And when you didn't do that, you saw what happened again with the Muslim ban, of just how much turmoil you can create.
Okay, one more quick question on it. Then process-wise, what happens? We get these reports that maybe it may or not have gone well, that there were problems. Is that the sort of thing that the Congress takes up, or it's the sort of thing that we report on, the Defense Department learns from it, and we just move on?
Each incident has a different path and a different set of circumstances. That certainly be internal DOD investigations that take place. I would not be surprised if it's up to, in some respects, to leadership and the chairman of committees like Oversight and Government Reform to look at this, as well as in the Intelligence Committee and Defense Committees to be briefed on these sorts of things. Just remember the tragedy of Pat Tillman's death. Do you recall those circumstances? I mean, Mr. Waxman was investigating that for a long period of time. So I believe there'll be thorough analysis and investigation across the board on this sort of thing. I think that's the way it should be, and we will follow up as well.
Talking to Congressman Mike Quigley, that is part of his role on the Intelligence Committee. But the reason he's on the phone is to talk about the tech community here, the innovative community in Chicago, and maybe nationwide as well, and the impact on that community when it comes to the president's immigration moves over the weekend. I mean, I think everyone agrees it was rolled out badly. So there's that. And then there's the wider sort of implications that come from it. And Congressman, I know tech is kind of worried. They don't like this. I mean, what do you see of all of that?
Well, there's no mistake that the CEOs of companies like Google, Apple, Facebook, and Airbnb share their near unanimous opposition to the order. And it's equally important, the universities that often, as you know, feed into the tech communities and rely on immigrants, whether they're students, their teachers, and so forth, come from all across the world. I mean, globalization is a reality. We are far more connected than we ever have been. And to isolate ourselves in a way like this is just improbable, unconstitutional, immoral. From a business point of view, a really bad idea. It's not just the tech community. And I have to throw in, well, we're talking about national security when we talk about the raid in Yemen. From a strategic point of view, what keeps America safe? I thought it was interesting. The King of Jordan said something along the lines of, I thought ISIS was the target here. If you put something in place like this, you have to remember that Muslim countries like Jordan and like Egypt are incredibly important to us and important partners to keep them safe, to keep us safe, to keep our other allies safe. And it makes it very difficult for them to hold all this together and keep our strategic allies together on things to keep as much possible unity and safety in the Middle East and therefore here.
Let me argue for the administration, and I think this, if I can make their case, they're going to say, look, this is a 90-day ordeal. We're tightening up restrictions. Presumably at the end of 90 days, we'll look at it, and we will start, we will reopen what has already been a very slow and tedious process. But after 90 days, we will have taken our look. We will have done what we need to do, and then we're back at it. The flow resumes, as slow as it might be. Where's the harm there?
I think the harm comes from not consulting with, as we're learning about this, the administration didn't consult with any of the people that they would have access to in Homeland Security, State Department, any of our allies, aviation. So it's never a good idea to do something and not tell anybody about it and then have people stranded or people, there are foreigners stranded here. They're Americans stranded elsewhere. There's no logic. There's no rhyme. There's no reason. Conservative Republican senators, as conservative as they get, have said, even if you think this is a moral idea or a smart idea or a constitutional idea, it was horribly vetted. So my response would be, what's the rush? Why can't you, if you're worried about tightening the vetting process, and we can debate that, why don't you use the resources you have? Because right now it is very campaign-like of Mr. Trump to shoot from the hip with flippant, superficial answers not based on facts and reality, and the result is the chaos that does not solve your problems. It hurts our image, which is very important across the rest of the world, and blemishes, I think, where we are with other countries' views of people who we are going to rely on to keep us safe.
All right.
This has done the opposite of what the administration wants.
I want to move to that, to the minute or so we have left, to your legislation that would protect sanctuary cities like Chicago. All right, you're in the minority in the House. I don't assume that this piece of legislation is going to be voted on, let alone passed. But what can you do, or what do you expect from the Trump administration when it comes on cracking down on sanctuary cities like Chicago? Or do you think you're going to get it passed?
Look, I'm an optimistic guy. I was cheering for the Cubs for 50 years before they won the World Series.
And it happened.
But I'm not that. Yeah, I'm not that. This is probably a longer shot. And let's just remember, we wouldn't have to do this if the House had taken up comprehensive immigration reform when the Senate passed it on a bipartisan basis. Look, we introduced this to extend the debate and to help people understand the issues in greater detail, and the fact that something like this is something that Republicans railed against when we were talking about highway safety issues. Right? We'll cut your federal funding for highways if you don't raise your drinking age to 21, if you don't have seatbelt laws. They always railed against that as sort of a federal intrusion, saying it violated the 10th Amendment. Well, clearly that didn't, but this does, because the 10th Amendment speaks exactly against what they're trying to do. And if they actually cut this funding, the funding we're most likely talking about is funding that will keep Chicagoans safe. So, again, it works in the exact opposite direction of what a ban of sanctuary cities works in the exact opposite direction as the administration would like it to.
That's Congressman Mike Quigley from the North Side of Chicago Democrat. Have you ever talked to the Australian Prime Minister? And if so, are you polite?
I have talked to the Australian ambassadors and other leadership there. I would remind the administration that Australia is one of the four countries outside the United States that we cooperate most closely with, sharing intelligence, which keeps us safe. Having a bad conversation as your first conversation and allegedly hanging up on the gentleman, this is not a good start.
Great to talk to you, Congressman. I will never hang up on you, even if I call you by the wrong name from time to time.
All good. Thank you so much.
We'll talk again soon. All right, thanks. So it is 12:53. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Elise Glink is in the house. Elise, the host of the, well, co-host, right? Monday Morning Marketing Podcast. John still hangs out, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. We hang out together. We just did a couple of episodes, and that was a lot of fun. We're sort of shifting it up for the new year.
Best Money Moves as well. BestMoneyMoves.com. Check that out. All right. So one of the podcasts, was the most recent one, talked about niche marketing.
Yeah, we just put it up, I think, Monday or Tuesday. And it's what we talk about in it is this idea that you can make a lot of money from very, very niche markets. And the internet helps you exploit that. You just have to exploit the internet exploiting that.
Okay, well, let's explain for me what that is. But here's my question. If it's a niche, it's a smaller target, right? So if you miss, it's a smaller target to hit.
Mm-hmm.
So if you miss it, you're really in trouble.
Well, there's a couple of ways to think about niche, right? So there's an idea that you're picking a very narrow target, and I love to use Steve Bertrand Travel.
I love it when you do that.
But you've
dot
got
com.
Dot com, right. So you've got, let's say, a trip to Ireland, right?
Mm-hmm.
So people who want to go to Ireland, that's a niche, right? And people who want to go to Ireland in the summer. And if you put some other sort of qualification on it, it would get an even further slice. But there's a reverse way to do a niche, where you still have that same trip, but now you're marketing to maybe seniors who want to take it or parents who have children who want to take them on a family trip to Ireland in July. There are a lot of different types of people who might want to do that trip. And so when you think about identifying a niche, there's the singular niche, right, that you're going to market to everybody, or there's a lot of little niche groups that you're going to market your product to.
Okay, and so let's say it's seniors going to Ireland in May.
Okay.
All right. So where am I going with that? How am I finding that niche?
Well, what you want to do is search what I would
do. By the way, not right now, but maybe someday soon.
Yeah, right. So what I would do if that were me is I would want to look at what the target market is actually searching for online. And then I would want to make the content of the trip where you want to direct them to, the landing page.
Right.
I would want to make it that target match what they're actually searching for.
How do you find out what they're searching for?
So Google has Google Trends. There are AdWords, keywords that you can look at. You can start to identify what it is that's driving people to that particular page, to a page that's sort of similar to yours. And you can start to, in Twitter, they have, you just go look at the analytics behind it, or if it's through a Facebook page, you can actually describe in a Facebook ad who you're trying to reach, age, demographics, you know, whether male or female,
right,
or other, any of the 51 others that Facebook has. Or you can identify them by income level, by target market of the country. You can even get as far down as very local areas.
Okay, so I've not really done that, but let's say I have a trip.
Mm-hmm.
And really, you brought it up, not me. I don't want to.
Oh, I know.
Okay, say I have a trip.
Yeah.
And I want to use just Facebook to find an audience in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
I can work with Facebook to define that audience, create an ad that will go only to them.
Yeah, exactly. And so it becomes really cost effective because to reach, they'll tell you, you know, to reach 1,500 people that match your demographic might cost you, I'm making this up, $15 or $150.
Right.
But it's not a tremendous amount of money. And because you're going so niche, right, maybe you only need that ad to hit the right 1,600 people in order to get, let's say, I don't know, 20 to go on your trip for
okay,
you.
Then let's go back to where we started as we wrap up. If I understand that, and it's much more likely to succeed if you are meeting your sort of P1 people, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you're slightly missing your P1 people, you might be in trouble. So is more money for a broader net sometimes a safer route?
Well, I wonder if it isn't better to do several targeted, less expensive niche tests.
So you miss three times and hit four.
Right. And so what you do is you learn by going to the different markets, you get smarter about the ads you place, you get smarter about how you describe the market you're trying to reach, and you get smarter about the content each time. You should, if you're guided by somebody smart, somebody who knows what they're doing,
right,
you should actually become extremely efficient in the amount of money you're spending to acquire the audience you want. And that's really the benefit of target niche marketing.
I get smarter every time you talk to me, Elise Glink. How do people find out more information?
You can find me on Twitter at Glink or thinklink.com or bestmoneymoves.com.
Thanks for coming by. Good to see you.
You too. See ya.